Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey nerds, welcome to episode 528 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. Just Adam on this Monday episode. I am so overjoyed with the conversation that I got to have that you're about to hear in just a moment. I sat down via Zoom, of course, with Suleika Jawad, who is the now New York Times best-selling author of Between Two Kingdoms. You may also know Suleika from her New York Times column, Life Interrupted, and she had a TED Talk that that was viewed millions of times over the past couple of years. Suleika, when she was 22, was diagnosed with leukemia, and she was given a prognosis that she had about a 30% chance of living. Spoiler alert, she is alive. That was about a decade ago. And she wrote this book about her experience, but not just about her experience of going through the diagnosis and the treatment, but also how she struggled to and then found her way in transitioning back to real life, kind of between the kingdom of the sick and the kingdom of the living. It's a very poignant conversation because of all the isolation she had to do while sick and in the hospital. Compares greatly with all of the isolation we've all been experiencing now for a full calendar year. Every once in a while I get to have a conversation with someone where it just instantly feels like we're kind of clicking and on the same page. And that's sort of how I felt chatting with Suleika. Her book, again, it's her first book. It came out, I think, 3 weeks ago at this point, and it debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list. And it's just one of those books where it has stayed with me. And I know that it's going to be one that I think of all year round. It's heartbreaking, but also inspirational. And I think you're just going to love it. If you have feedback on this or any of our episodes, you can, of course, always go to professionalbooknerds.com to contact us, or just email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com, or just shoot us a tweet or a message on Instagram at ProBookNerds. I would love to hear from you. I hope you guys check out this book, borrow it, listen to the audiobook, which Suleika does, go buy it, buy a copy of it for a friend or a family member. It's just a very special book. It's one, you know, only these books don't come around that often. And I implore you to read this one. I'm not going to keep you any longer. I'm going to let you get right to this conversation. So I hope you guys enjoyed this chat with the truly incredible Suleika Jawad on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Do you want to just kind of kick us off by giving our listeners maybe an introduction to Between Two Kingdoms?
Sure. So Between Two Kingdoms is my first book. It's a memoir about a difficult passage in my 20s, following a diagnosis of leukemia when I was 22. But more than that, it's about the imprints of major life disruptions on our minds, on our bodies, on our relationships. And it's about aftermaths, what happens when we survive what was thought to be unsurvivable, and we have to figure out how to begin anew. And that's very much been my work in the last decade as I've emerged from this experience. And it was, you know, an experience that felt so omnipresent that it became my subject, even though that wasn't necessarily something I sought out or planned.
Well, and something that I was really, I loved about your book is, you know, it's obviously it's called Between Two Kingdoms, and you talk a lot about, you know, the difference between like the kingdom of the living and the kingdom of, you know, the sick. And, but what I loved about the book is so often, I think when people, and I know you've heard these things before about like, oh, your journey as a cancer survivor. And, but you extend the book beyond your, you know, your bout with cancer, your fight, your whatever, your journey, whatever you want to, you know, insert noun here, but you extend beyond that and talk about what kind of happens next. And I just, I love that concept of, you know, living beyond like a moment and answering sort of now what. And so, you know, when you were writing the book, did you always know that you wanted it to be both aspects of the process, or was it something that sort of came along organically when you started writing about, you know, your time in hospitals and everything like that?
So when I started to think about writing a book, I didn't want to write about illness. In fact, I was desperate to write about anything else. And at that time, I had the great honor of interviewing Cheryl Strayed. And she gave me some advice that I think is excellent advice, which is essentially that I would write the story I needed to write. And I had no business trying to avoid that. And she was right. So I knew I wanted to write about the aftermath of that experience. I was interested in reentry. You know, I remember when I was sick reading, you know, all kinds of different illness narratives and cancer books. And the final act of that book was always, you know, the survivorship, the cure. But no one really seemed to give much ink to what happened after. So I think because of that, in my mind, you know, the goal was obviously to survive and to be cured, even if that didn't always feel within the realm of the possibility or within the realm of possibility. And I'm not sure I gave much thought as to what would happen after that. I think I just kind of assumed I would return to the kingdom of the well, that I'd kind of organically and eagerly fold back into the rhythms of living. But that didn't happen. You know, and reentry and the challenges of it is something that we talk about in the context of, you know, prisoners returning from war or, soldiers returning from war and prisoners being released. But it's not really something we talk about in the context of other kinds of traumas like an illness. And so I found myself in this place where I felt like I should feel, you know, grateful and excited and ready to start living my life again. But in fact, I never felt more lost. And I felt, you know, suspended in this strange kind of liminal space.
Well, and I think that's why so many people are relating to your book, even if they've never personally been touched by, you know, a sickness that you have, is because there's this concept of reentry that you talk so much about, and this expectation that, like, okay, so like, now you're okay, goodbye. And it's like, that's not how life works. And I think there's so many versions of that that people can relate to, whether it's even something like graduating college. Like, you know, it's that weird feeling where you go and you get your diploma, and let's be honest, we're all super hungover and like sweating in your gowns. And like, there's this huge celebration, and then you get handed this diploma and you've in theory moved out of your, you know, apartment or, you know, dorm room, wherever you're living. And maybe your family goes to like the Olive Garden or somewhere to get a lunch. And then it's like, okay, figure it out. And it is, it's like in all aspects of life, there's this concept of reentry where it's like, but it's so rare that like, it's almost like you just kind of get pushed off the deep end. And it's like, like you said, you walked out of the hospital and it's like, all right, continue living your life that you had to put on hold for so long. Like, it's, I don't know. This, again, this isn't really a question so much as just like, I think so many people can understand that concept.
Well, and it occurs to me that we're all kind of living that now, since the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Like in the early days when everyone and everything went into lockdown, we were talking about it as like a pause or an interruption. And I think that was like aspirational thinking. There was this sense that, okay, we have to do this for a couple of weeks and then life will return to normal. And of course, you know, almost a year later, here we still are, you know, many of us isolated at home. And if we are kind of stepping out into the world, we're wearing masks and we're doing so with a sense of hypervigilance. And it's, I think it's a difficult process because there may be a clear kind of endpoint to life mm-hmm. before, but the beginnings of reentry aren't as clear and the path forward is murky. And I know that for me, you know, I certainly felt that sense when I graduated from college and I felt it in a heightened way when I finished treatment. But it was this feeling of like, I can't return to the person that I was, but I have no idea who I am now and how to find my way forward.
It's interesting, like you talk, you know, comparing, you know, thinking about the pandemic and like reentry from that. You talk in your book about it, almost, it's a strange concept, like missing the hospital ecosystem in the sense of like the people and the kind of daily driving purpose of like, okay, you know, this goal that you have is to keep your existence, to survive, to live. And then, you know, after you've achieved, as you know, you've, like you said, you've been, you know, declared healthy, like now what? And I've been thinking about that a lot with the pandemic, because, you know, I see my parents every once in a while now, but it's still like outside and like from a distance, and they both thankfully got their, they've both been vaccinated, they're a little bit older, and it's like the relief I felt, I didn't even know I was holding my breath when they told me those things. But I've been thinking a lot about it, like our company is beginning to think about the process of when we'll all come back to the office, and it's this like unnerving feeling that I didn't even know I had, because I've started to be like, wait, I've, as much as I'm lonely all the time in my home, I know that I don't want, like, it's almost like I don't want to leave this isolation because I'm afraid of, I just, of what is happening in the change. And yeah, I don't know. It's a strange concept to understand that the world's going to open up again. And I'm almost like, do I want to become a part of that world again?
Totally. And I don't know about you. And I felt this, you know, when I was in treatment, and I felt it in this last year during the pandemic, like when possibility and choice is removed, there's a strange kind of centering quality to that. Like all the busyness and the artifice gets stripped away and our days are simpler. And, you know, we have clear parameters for what we can do and what we can't do. And part of what I think is so disorienting about reentry is the reintroduction of choice. You suddenly have so many more opportunities and so many more decisions. And that feels overwhelming. And there's a degree of uncertainty about how to proceed and what you want to carry with you from the experience you're emerging from and what that means. And I also think, you know, in these periods of isolation, whether they're chosen or forced, there's a clarity that comes with that and a kind of rerouting of priorities. And then when you find yourself in a position of being able to, you know, re-enter the world or to navigate the world beyond your windows, it's, at least for me, it's hard to know always how to apply that clarity and apply what's been learned to whatever comes next.
Yeah. Along those lines, do you, because I agree. I feel like trivial things that maybe I didn't realize were trivial when I could see, I have a big family and it's chaos all the time. And like, you know, there's these petty squabbles, you know, siblings will have, or like, you know, being sassy about how my sister might be teaching one of her four kids, even though I don't have kids myself, like, you know, like those little things that now I'm just like grateful to FaceTime with them. And so I'm like realizing these small things that like I would stress about, I mean, aren't as important. Like after, you know, overcoming everything that you did, like, do you find small things to be a little, like, do you not worry about them as much? Seems things like even like deadlines or like, do you find yourself understanding their like place in the grander scheme of things, or do you still worry about them? Have you like been able to, I don't want to say return to normalcy because none of us are having a normal life right now, but like, do things like that stress you out less, or do you still find yourself thinking about them?
It's such a good question. I mean, I remember about a year after I finished cancer treatment, I was having lunch with a friend and my hair was awkwardly growing out and I had a kind of pseudo mullet, and I made some comment about like having a bad hair day and being embarrassed about my mullet. And my friend Jen turned to me and said, "Don't be an asshole. You're so lucky to have hair." And yeah. I said, "You're so right." But the bigger thing that I felt was that it was such a privilege to get to fret about the small things.
Yeah.
It meant that I was well enough and healthy enough to worry about trivial things like my hair. So I think, you know, it's a balancing act. On the one hand, you know, we do get these epiphanies and realizations that come when our life has been dramatically disrupted, or we feel somehow a heightened sense of our mortality, and that's useful information. But also, if we were all to live every day as if it were our last, we would first all go immediately bankrupt, and our world would probably combust into flames. So I'm always, you know, struggling to find that balance, to hold on to those kind of bigger realizations or priorities while also trying to return to some semblance of normalcy, and even to kind of revel in the small things, because it's a privilege to be able to revel and worry about the small things.
It's not your job to be like the person up on the mountain that everyone hikes to get like this life-changing advice. Like, yeah, sometimes you just want to be a human being, I imagine. Just be like, yeah, I want to complain about onions on the sandwich that I got takeout from. Like, it's
exactly.
Is there ever a frustration from you about people like asking you for like some massive piece of advice? Because I imagine when you sit down to be interviewed, or even just like if you are speaking with someone and they might know who you are, or they're familiar with your column in New York Times, like, and they're like, "Wow, can you tell me?" Like, does it ever get exhausting to be like, "Suleika, tell me something that is going to change my life"? Like, do you ever just want to be like, "Yes, I survived cancer. Yes, I have this platform, but I also am a human being"?
Well, so the interesting thing is, long before I'd written anything or was published after my diagnosis, I found that there was this way in which illness made it such that, you know, pretty much overnight with my diagnosis, people were suddenly calling me brave and inspiring and strong. And that never really resonated with me, because it, you know, this diagnosis wasn't something that I had chosen or wanted. And so those kinds of adjectives didn't feel earned. And I also think, you know, when you're someone who is staring down the imminent possibility of death, there's this way in which people seem to, and their minds transform you into that mountaintop sage. Like, there's something about being close to death that I think bestows a weird, you know, kind of like saint-like celestial quality on them. And I found that all very disorienting. And I, you know, bumped up against that sort of heroic survivor's narrative over and over and over again during my treatment. And it was a big source of frustration for me, even though I know that people meant well. But the kind of real acts of bravery and of strength, I think, for me, were the ones that were within my control. It wasn't the very fact of surviving or having gotten this diagnosis, but it was how I wanted to measure myself based on how I kind of responded to these circumstances. I have a quote. Let me see if I can find it. I have a big stack of post-it notes and quotes and things that I write down. It's under my laptop because I've been thinking about it a lot. But there's this line from Viktor Frankl that I think a lot about. And he wrote, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And that space is our power to choose our response. And our response lies our growth and our freedom." And so to me, that idea of like how we respond to the inciting event, to the stimulus, feels like the real test and measure of character and of strength.
Yeah, I love that so much. I have a friend that I've known since college that she, this past February, celebrated her 19th anniversary of her heart transplant. And it's the same thing. She always says, like, everyone always wants to ask about her journey, quote unquote, of receiving a new heart and how much courage it took. And she likes to joke all the time. She's like, "I'm not brave because the powers that be gave me a shitty heart." She's like, "If you want to talk about my quote unquote bravery, talk about the things I've done in the past decade," where she works with this place in Cleveland here called the Transplant House, and how she's basically like dedicated her life to working with like Life Bank to make sure that people are signed up to be an organ donor and to, you know, to give blood as frequently as possible. And because she said, she's like, you know, the brave person was the father who said, "Yes, my daughter just passed away and this heart that was hers can go to someone else." She's like, "I'm alive because of someone else's brave actions." And she's like, "And I've tried to, you know, not pay that forward," but she's like, "I've tried to use this life that I've been given to be brave." But like you said, the bravery didn't come in laying in that hospital bed for her. She's like, "I had to lay in a hospital bed. I wasn't awake doing the surgery myself. They put a heart in my body that I can now take advantage of." And yeah, does that get exhausting having people throw these adjectives about your fight?
Yeah. I mean, it is exhausting in a sense. And I also, though, like have reflected on why it is that we grasp for those adjectives. And I think, you know, our culture is really uncomfortable talking about hard things, especially death or the possibility of it. And so, you know, instead of it becoming an opportunity for a really vulnerable kind of raw conversation, we plaster over that discomfort and those fears with all kinds of like bumper sticker slogans and platitudes. And there were so many of them. I mean, like, "Search for the silver lining," or my least favorite, "God doesn't give you more than you can handle." Because of course, you know, it felt like God had sure as hell given me more than I could handle.
Thinking about that, like the concept that, I mean, obviously that's like, I feel like that's a whole other podcast of like the concept of like a higher power and like what they give us, and like just the thought of like there's infinite cosmos and universes and like this person or this thing that created all of it is going to care about this like individual person on this one planet. When writing this and going through, and then I know you also did the audiobook, you know, so rereading the stuff that you had read and worked on, like, was it cathartic to do it? Or, I mean, I know that the actual journey of going to speak with all of these different people who would connect with you, I imagine there was a lot of catharsis there, but like, was there a feeling of like, it felt better to get this story down on paper and then now endlessly talk about it with people like me? Or is it something that you were removed enough from everything you had experienced that it was just like, oh, I have a story I think I should share?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think when we talk about writing, there's this kind of like false division between like writing that feels cathartic and then serious literature.
Yeah.
And so when people would ask me that question in the past, I would always say, no, it's not catharsis. Like, this is my work. But the truth is, like, all writing feels cathartic for me. Yeah. And I think, you know, the opportunity to get to excavate these memories and to kind of search for the truths behind the truths behind the truths was a kind of catharsis, even when it felt really difficult and I wanted to just kind of hit my forehead against the desk.
Well, that's part of the writing process too. You have to do that.
Always. Yeah. Yeah. You know, whether I'm writing like a reported story about someone else, or I'm writing a personal essay, or right now I'm kind of toying with some ideas for fiction, I think I'm always trying to write towards some unanswered question that I'm grappling with in my own life. And the truth is, like, even since this book coming out, I'm still understanding that story differently. And that's the magic of writing and the subconscious, is you can write your way towards something. And even when you finish writing it and you think you've kind of understood it, you reread it again and realize, oh, actually I was writing about this, not about the thing I thought I was writing about.
Well, it's so interesting because I've had so many authors tell me over the years that people suggest, oh, write what you know. And then interestingly, recently I interviewed this author, Emma Stonex. She lives in England and she wrote this book called The Lamplighters, which I think just came out maybe like yesterday.
Congratulations, Emma.
Yeah. She wrote this book about, it's this book, this The Lamplighters, and it's this book about this thing that happened in 1900 where three lighthouse keepers in 1900 like disappeared, and it was off the coast of Scotland, and it's an unsolved mystery, quote unquote. And she was so fascinated by the story, and she was told by one of her like professors, write about stuff you don't know. And she's like, so I, knowing nothing about lighthouses, decided to write a whole mystery novel about them. And it was beautiful and it's a wonderful book, but like, it's interesting, this concept between, oh, write what you know, or write what you don't know, because this book I met was really both for you, right? It was like, obviously your story, but then, you know, there's a lot of, like you said, you're still discovering about how maybe other people will intake it, or also just like, even something as simple as when you wrote about like learning how to drive. There's so much there that's both.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's a combination of both those things. Like, I write from the place that I know toward the place that I don't know, if that makes sense. This idea of writing what I didn't want to know about myself became my kind of marching orders in the writing of this book.
So interesting. There's two things that are kind of connected that I want to ask you about. One is the 100 Day Project, which I am now obsessed with, and I have been noodling since I finished your book on like what I want my 100 Day Project to be. So talk about that in a second, and how it connects to, you've created this thing called the Isolation Journals, which I am also obsessed with. So first, can you explain to our listeners who haven't read Between Two Kingdoms yet what the 100 Day Project is? Because I cannot stop thinking about it. I feel like I'm going to spend 100 days thinking about my 100 Day Project. But what it is and how it sort of helps you maybe, you know, find a writing voice, or however it helps you.
Yeah. So that first summer after my diagnosis, I spent it in isolation in a hospital room, and I was in a really low down place. It was a dark place and an angry one. And I was like, intent on setting the world record for the number of Grey's Anatomy episodes watched consecutively. So when I wasn't sleeping, that's what I was doing. And my friends and family understandably were a little concerned. And so someone came up with the idea of doing a 100-day project. And the concept was really simple. We were each going to do one creative act every day for 100 days. And I think the idea was to create some sense of accountability and to find something that felt low stakes, but fun and productive for us to do during this strange time of living out of hospital rooms. So my dad wrote down 100 childhood memories that he compiled into a little book and gave to me at the end of it. My mom, who's a painter, painted a ceramic tile every day that she assembled into a shield and hung above my bed. She called it Suleika's shield and told me it had protective powers. And for my 100-day project, I returned to the thing I'd always done during my most difficult passages, which was keeping a journal. And I made a commitment to write every day for 100 days. It didn't matter the quality, it didn't matter how long. Often it was just, you know, a couple of sentences. Sometimes it was just the F word. But something interesting started to happen while I was keeping that journal. The first was which I, you know, was able to kind of tap back into my love of writing, but I noticed my writing was changing. And I started to use that journal almost as a kind of reporter's notebook. And I was recording, you know, overheard conversations among the nurses. I was writing about the different characters, other patients I was meeting in the hospital. I was surveying the quality of the hospital cafeteria food. I was, you know, really writing from the front lines of my hospital bed. And by the end of that 100 days, I realized I had a body of work. And much later, it became the source material for my New York Times column, Life Interrupted. But at the beginning of the pandemic, as you know, we all found ourselves stuck at home in isolation, mm-hmm. I started to think about how I could bring that project to a bigger community.
Yeah.
So that's how the Isolation Journals was born. And we send out free journaling prompts from all kinds of amazing artists and mm-hmm. thinkers and community leaders. And by the end of that first month, we had over 100,000 people who'd signed up, which was wild mm-hmm. and a little terrifying because it was supposed to be my side project while I was finishing the book and finishing grad school. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think, you know, to me, the journal is this really unique space where we get to do the writing that doesn't count.
Yeah.
And something for me about being creative in a low stakes environment mm-hmm. is the thing that allows me to kind of write in my most unedited voice. Yeah. And it's this incredibly liberating space. And so I'm a big proponent of journaling. It's a big part of my writing process for the mm-hmm. writing that does count. Most of my first drafts of things live in my journal before mm-hmm. they ever make it onto a Word doc. But yeah.
Well, and that's, I feel like just the simple concept of giving someone a prompt. Because if you put an empty Word document in front of someone and be like, journal, they're like, about what? But if you just ask like a simple question, like, you know, what's the first thing you're going to tell your mom when you see them? Or it's like, oh, yeah. Okay, there's a question for me. Yeah, I love that so much. I just wanted to make sure people were aware of that. And they can go to your website, correct? And they can still like yeah. join and everything. It's still going on.
They can go to theisolationjournals.com. Yeah. And so we send out these prompts once a week on Sundays. We also have an archive. We call it the Archive of Human Creativity, where people get to submit their journaling entries, mm-hmm. Which has been really interesting to just see how people interpret a single prompt in so many different ways and yeah. in so many different genres. I mean, journaling, you know, the beauty of it is that there are no constraints. Some people mm-hmm. journal through painting, others journal through songwriting.
Yeah.
So it's been probably the highlight of this last year.
Yeah. That makes me so happy. Okay, so towards the end of our podcast, we like to ask 9 lighthearted questions that we call the Nerd 9 because I like alliteration. I used to call them rapid fire, and then people would say, Adam, please stop saying that because I get on tangents all the time. But the first one is, what is the last book you finished reading?
Excellent question. The last book I finished rereading is The Collected Schizophrenias by Esme Weijin Wang.
Do you have a favorite place to read?
I bought this reclining armchair off of Craigslist that's in my office, and it's incredibly comfortable, and I feel like I'm lying in a bed.
Okay, no one else is going to see this. Is it the chair behind you right now?
Yes, it is.
It looks ludicrously comfortable. I actually noticed that. I was like, oh my God, I want to lay a mat.
I actually even put a really soft, fluffy sheepskin over it, which somehow just, increases its allure and makes me want to spend all day, every day reading for many hours in that chair.
Oh, man.
Every reader, every writer needs a really excellent reclining armchair.
Yeah. No one else will see this on our Zoom. Man, I like looked at it when you first logged on. I was like, oh, I want to sit there. Do you remember the book that maybe made you fall in love with reading when you were a kid?
My mom read me Wuthering Heights out loud over the, it took us a couple months to get through it when I was in the second grade. And I
second
remember
grade.
Thinking, yeah, yeah, she was a very, yeah. evolved mom, but I remember just being so enchanted and thinking to myself, I think I'd like to also be able to tell stories, maybe not quite on that level, but in my own way.
This next one is a weird question admittedly to ask over the past year, but when we can travel again, where is some place you'd like to go that you have not yet visited?
I'd like to go to Algeria.
Do you have a favorite holiday to celebrate?
Christmas.
Are you a coffee person or a tea person?
Both, but I'm on my third coffee of the day right now, so I'll go with coffee.
Anyone who listens to your or reads your book will know, I think, the answer to this one, but cats or dogs?
Oh, dogs.
Yeah.
Big time.
Do you have a favorite food?
You know what? You can never go wrong with a good grilled cheese sandwich.
Beautiful. Okay, last one of these. If you could have dinner with one person, alive or dead, who would you pick? I know, I'm sorry. I regret ever writing this question down, but it's been years now, so I have to keep asking it.
Okay, so many people are coming to mind, but the person who comes to mind right now is Cheryl Strayed. I have been reading a lot of travel memoirs. Since my book came out, I couldn't read them while I was working on the book because they felt too close.
Yeah.
I've been reading Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things again, and thinking of her and wishing very much we could kind of compare notes, not just about the experience of going on these epic boondoggles that we did in our 20s, but the act of writing about them.
I think that's perfect. Okay, last question for you, Suleika. If you, what do you hope readers take away from reading Between Two Kingdoms?
I think there's a sense when we emerge from a difficult situation that we have to move on, and that we have to kind of put the wreckage of the past behind us and start living again. And I wish 2 things. One, that they realize moving on is a myth and that in fact it's going to be more of a process of moving forward, and that they also find some way to honor that space between no longer and not yet, be it with a road trip or some other kind of ritual or rite of passage.
That is absolutely perfect. I haven't been able to stop thinking about your book, and it was such a joy to be able to chat with you. Suleika, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Adam. Adam is my brother's name. So I feel a kind of immediate tenderness towards anyone I meet who's named Adam. This is so fun and I'm so honored, and I can't wait to hear it and to dive into your other podcast interviews.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.